Kia ora, welcome to the Power Up Podcast, powered by Te Puna Umanga, Venture Taranaki, and produced by Raw Collective. This podcast highlights and celebrates Taranaki business owners doing awesome things across the region. We talk to trailblazing founders and entrepreneurs to get the inside word of their journeys. It's a glimpse into the reality of success stories, where people talk about their wins, challenges, and how living in Taranaki shapes their work and lifestyle. I'm David Downs, and this is the latest in a series all about exceptional Taranaki businesses and thriving Taranaki people. Nau mai, haere mai, we welcome you to hear all about our enterprising story like no other. Terry Boone is behind dozens of recognisable buildings and homes around Taranaki, New Zealand and beyond. He is the founding director of Boone, a leading New Plymouth design and architecture firm. Terry started the business in 1974, and it has gradually grown to now work across architecture, landscape, and urban design, event, brand, and experience. As well as being a leader through his work, he has contributed to a whole raft of community organizations over a very long time, and he goes into why so many of these causes are so important to him. Terry talks about his lifetime in business, including highlights and challenges, and some of his favorite projects over the course of 50 years. He touches on the relationships that have fueled his success and also how being in Taranaki has enabled him to live the life he has, and he's certainly not done yet. Well, kia ora, welcome Terry. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're looking very summery and relaxed. Well, you've been in Taranaki many, many years.
87 years.
87 years, you're kidding.
No, I was born here. Wow. December 1937.
My word. Gosh, you don't look like you're 87, I have to say, but it's
thank you.
Remarkable. And are you fully retired now, or if someone rang you up with an interesting project, would you get involved?
I am still involved in a few projects.
Oh, really?
I still go to the office every day.
Really?
I've still got a car park right outside the front door, and we have quite a big studio office now. We've got a reasonably big staff.
Yeah.
And there's only one person with an office. Yours right. Truly. I'm hardly ever there. But for the moment, nobody's given me the DCM.
Maybe they've been a little bit worried. You know, they want to, you know, honour you and your work that you've done. And
well, I've told them when my use-by date is done. I've told them probably I might start reduce my hours when I'm 100.
Yeah, good.
But probably at 120, I'll then probably say, no, that's enough.
Yeah, yeah, but hang up your tools. I mean, you'll have done a few days' work by then, 120. I can look at you, I feel it might be actually true. Nice. So 87 years on the planet and at least 50 years in the business, from what I understand.
Yes, last year was 50 years, since I started the firm.
Yeah. And there's a bit of an old joke about builders when they drive past a house, they go, I did that. Out of that.
Well,
is that what you do?
I've got a bit of that here.
Yeah, every 5 minutes you'd be pointing at something.
A bit embarrassing, yeah, because I worked for 4 or 5 years before that.
Yeah.
It was only when I started my firm we talked about the 50 years.
That's incredible.
Mm.
And when you look back at that 50 years, you know, and everything you did, you know, what's your feeling at the moment? I mean, even though you're not done yet, we get that, but you look back at the 50-year mark and are you pretty satisfied and happy?
Oh, I suppose I've got to say that I feel very privileged on a number of levels to be born in Taranaki and to have spent most of my life here apart from living in London and Saudi Arabia and a few other places and travelling extensively.
Yeah.
I've just loved being in Taranaki. There's something about it because I used to ski and I love the sea, used to surf life saving, all that sort of stuff. So we've got everything here. I mean, the topography, the location, the mountain, the sea. I mean, it's unique.
It is.
In the Pukekura Park, you know, we've got these gems here that were created when this place was a village, you know.
Yeah.
People had vision in the early days, had real vision.
They did.
Vision's something that's lacking a wee bit at the moment, I think.
Big changes, though, in those 87 years that you've lived here.
Yeah, quite a few, although, you know, the old adage is that everything stays the same, really, in a way, because the basic structure of New Plymouth hasn't changed. Our claim to fame, the longest main street in the Southern Hemisphere, which apparently it is, suppose 5 miles it used to be called, from Blagdon to out to Fitzroy. Pretty extraordinary. Yeah, I think there's just something special about this place. that I've just never, ever tired of.
Yeah.
I just love it. Every day I wake up, I live up on Rogan Street. I look out. I've got a glass box in the front of my house.
Yeah.
I designed 56 years ago. And I look over the city and the sea, Paratutu, up the coast to Tongatrutu, and walk out the back door and there's the Moanga.
Wow.
And you've got to say, wow.
It gets
doesn't
you,
get better than this.
No. When you can see it, of course. When the
well, it's surprising how often you can see it. And, of course, often it's very shy. It
hides away. Yes. Hides away. But I also heard that Pukekura Park might be a special place for you.
It is, apart from the fact I've had a lot to do with various parts, like the Bowl of Brooklands.
Yeah.
I worked on for 35 years. I was on the trust in the early days with Denny Sutherland.
Yeah.
And co, and then I slowly got involved in designing things and changing the lake, and I don't know if you remember, but it used to be a great big lake.
Yeah.
You remember it in the days, and then they used to have some wooden seats, had a funny little sound shell thing, and then there was a big flat area and very steep banks.
Yeah.
So if you got to a show a bit late and you had to sit behind the people on the seats because you couldn't see anything, you just hear it, or you'd hang on like goat on right. the really steep.
Try not to slide
so
down.
So one of the big breakthroughs was firstly, reducing the lake, which they told me I'd gone mad about several times. I've been told I'm mad. But I reduced it down. You don't need a lot of water to get the reflection, as has been proven.
Right.
And then I knew that the Old Boys Rugby Club, which was just across the road off Carrington Street, had quite a big hill. They wanted an extra ground. Rugby had, at that stage was flourishing.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, here we are. We put two and two together. We took the big hill and brought it over and filled up the bowl.
Yeah.
And that was one of the times I was going mad. They were ringing Mayor Claire Stewart and Sampson, the CEO, saying Boone's lost the plot because he's now filling the bowl in. There won't be any bowl left because there's 150-odd thousand cubic metres of dirt. Jesus. And instead of it being like that and steep, it's graded in three different levels, so everyone sits comfortably.
Yeah.
And everybody can see.
That's brilliant.
So it was a dramatic change of the bowl.
Yeah.
And the second big change, I suppose, or I don't know whether you remember, but in the early days they used to park the trucks and around the on the left-hand side,
yeah.
the northern side of the sound shell, or the stage, and there was a bridge across. They used to cart all the stuff over. And I said, look, we've got to change that. And I managed to persuade, I think, Alan Jellyman, who was the director of the Parks and Reserves, that we could come down the road from the racecourse
yeah.
and create a road around the back of the bowl and a manoeuvring area, which yeah. we did after a struggle because we had to remove a tree, which was very, very
careful.
Very careful.
Environmental.
And today we probably wouldn't do it. Even then it was bad enough. But we did it, and what a difference, because all the service vehicles.
You get in. That's the stuff that people don't notice.
The performers and that. It's
yeah.
like a theatre.
Yeah.
I mean, you see they come the stage door off the street, and that you don't see the performers come down the main road to the platform.
Yeah.
So that was a huge.
Yeah.
People would take it for granted, but it was a massive improvement. And
yeah.
it really suddenly made it a theatre.
Yeah.
Not just a big grass
just
bowl.
Just a big grass. But, and it's because obviously it's one of the iconic venues of New Zealand.
Extraordinary.
You know, there aren't many like it. And you still get the big international artists who want to play the bowl because
they
it's
love
just
it. Well, there's something about there. It. Yeah. I went to a big show in Sydney. They've got the thing they call the Myers Bowl. Myers
yep.
is a big family there.
Yeah.
And it's similar. It's a bigger sort of amp, but it's all concrete.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, the bowl with all the trees all around
yeah,
it.
It's got this
the whole atmosphere
spirit.
Is just extraordinary.
Yeah. And you've worked on a few other big things too. I mean, reshaping the Bowl of Brooklands is one thing, but then if you go from the bowl to Riyadh, I'm just looking here and going, how do you go from doing something in New Plymouth to suddenly Saudi Arabia?
Well, that was pretty interesting, really. The It's because that was really a highlight of my life because, firstly, to win the project because there were four big companies from Auckland and Wellington
yeah.
who had been interviewed, plus yours truly. And I'd had an experience. I've been in Tehran the year before for a number of reasons, one mainly to see a building that had been done by the Frank Lloyd Wright Fellowship. There was an outreach of what they call the Talazan Foundation, which was a base of Frank Lloyd Wright, if you've heard of him.
I've heard of Frank Lloyd Wright, Falling Water and all that.
Yes, and unbelievable. And so I had been to Tehran, and I could t- talk pretty knowledgeably about conditions in the desert and what how you have to build and so on. And I'd also been somewhere else, which gave me some. Oh, no, I'd met a one of the. I was at a wake after a funeral in Auckland the week before the interview, and I met one of the directors of McConnell Dow, a guy called Dow.
Yeah.
He was at this wake, and I knew he'd done a lot of work over in Saudi, so I grilled him for an hour on the processes of working there and all the rest of it. So when I had the interview, I sounded like I was a bloody expert.
Just remembering something I heard the other day. Yeah, and, that's my secret too. That's what I just do. Tell, say, well, I've heard from someone else. It's good.
But I had. I also went down there. I sat out. I flew down for the interview. So it was. I forget what it was. Say 2 o'clock, and I sat outside in the square in the middle of Wellington and just meditated for an hour before the thing. I just went into the zone and. Went up there and just nailed it, and I thought, well, I've done. I came away thinking I've done my best.
Yeah,
because I know that. Well, I heard afterwards that some of the other bigger companies, the big names, who incidentally were pissed off that I and in fact, I'll come back to that as well, which tells you a thing about architects. Is that, oh, however I did, enthusiasm. I was absolutely madly enthusiastic, and I said, you know, if I got this job. I would probably go there and look after it. I said, "This to me, this would be a real crowning achievement. It would be something really special."
Yeah, yeah.
So I flew back, and then the next morning I get this phone call. Are you sitting down? You've got the job. I said, "Oh my goodness, thank you. Well, you know what happened then, because I'd been president of the Institute of Architects.
Yes.
And I'd also been heavily involved in politics. I stood for Parliament
in
1972.
Oh.
But it was a serious attempt.
Yep.
It was a time when National was had been in for a long time, 12 years, I think.
Right.
With Keith Holyoake as the Prime Minister. And it was the old Labour under Kirk had a its time or something. Something there was some slogan,
they had, right.
Which see, these guys have been here too long.
Right.
And I don't pray much, but I do every now and put my hands together and say thank you somebody, because if I'd got into Parliament, my life would have been totally different.
Completely, yeah.
And of course, I went and lived there. And it's a magnificent job I did. And I loved it.
Yeah,
it was a real highlight of my life.
Oh, fantastic! Mm. Has it been an issue for you being based in New Plymouth or over the years?
Well,
was it harder or easier sometimes to be away from it?
Well, I was always involved in committees. I was always involved on, you know, every organisation in town, Surf Life Saving, you name it. I just got involved because I believe in being involved if my kids were involved.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't do it for rewards. I did it because I loved being involved.
Yeah.
And only things that I really felt strongly about, generally. Things like the Bowl of Brooklands, you know, I feel strongly about that.
Yeah.
And it was a privilege to be involved with Denny Sutherland and all those other guys that were instigators of that.
Oh, fantastic.
Mm.
Can we go right back to, maybe not right back, 87 years?
1850.
1850? Now I know you're not. I mean, you're of New Plymouth. You're of this place. You said you were born here, brought up here. Seen all the changes, and as you said earlier, that, you know, sometimes the changes are actually just the same thing again in a different guise.
Yes.
But what is it? What are those changes that you've seen over the years in Taranaki? Because the essence of the land has stayed the same, and the people, probably just the spirit of the people here too.
I believe, again, because of our isolation, because we punch above our weight in rugby and just about anything we do. We seem to be, you know, look at, we've got this TSB Stadium, the TSB Bowl of Brooklyn. I mean, TSB, I'm mentioning too often. But, you know, they were great supporters.
Yeah.
And I think the changes have, interesting, they've been very incremental. There's been nothing major, really. We've had, I think, pretty good local authorities. Taranaki Regional Council has been led by people like Laurie Hickford and Denny Sutherland, Daisy Lean. I mean, we've had guys who were visionaries, really, and did things. You know, the walkway, simple things like the walkway that Mayor Claire Stewart put together. What a difference that makes when you can walk along that coastline.
It's huge. Yeah, it's a great
feature.
People
take it for granted, but it's unbelievable when you think about it. And, of course, now you can go from Paratutu to Waitara the whole way. It's open now. You can bike the whole way.
It's beautiful. I walked it last night, actually, while I was here, and I walked down to the new playground, which has just been put in, and, and that's done through the generosity of
a lot of people here, which
is awesome. It's another feature of this place, actually. The people that are of this place stay very connected. Even if they travel, they feel like they're still part of the place.
I reckon. And say we've had some visionaries, and the Bryce Barnett's one who's done a lot of work. He put together so many things. But, you know, we have had people, the Mollers and... the Sutherlands and just one after the
and
other.
And Mr. Boone down here too. He's always been good. Now, but you just reading here, you did at one point go and freedom camp around Europe like some sort of hippie with your child.
Well, that was pretty extraordinary because I'd never camped in my life. We'd always had a batch out at even during the restrictions in 45, during the war, things were restricted. And my family were at mill and were building contractors and had the whole... thing. We had our own plumbers, painters, drain layers, joinery factories, timber mills. We had the whole thing. And my father built this batch at Oakura, which it weren't really supposed to do, but it was sort of surplus timber that fell off the back of a truck. I gather. And so it meant I spent most of my life out there at the beach. I had never camped, but we... my wife was born in Kenya to New Zealand parents, and she was used to travelling a lot, and we had a baby. We got married in 1961, had a baby in 1962, and in 1963, the Decembers were, the 60s were big, important. December 60, I qualify as an architect.
Yeah.
61, I got married. 62, we had a baby. But in those days, we didn't know what we were doing, really.
Yeah.
And the next December, we climbed on a boat. And I'd worked night and day. I had a job, and I worked on PJs, private jobs.
Yep.
And climbed on this fair sea, an Italian ship with a baby, and sailed for 6 weeks to London.
Wow.
Got to London, bought a dormobile, which was a Bedford thing with a rooflet lifted up. And the baby slept on the top. We had the two front seats, which were steel frames, would fold down. We had a seat, a double sleeping bags, which were zipped, and we slept in those. Bloody uncomfortable because you're always on the and cooked in the back. Never ate in a restaurant ever.
Right.
Went into the markets, bought food, and Angela cooked in the back. How the hell she did it? Because she was also pregnant again.
Gosh.
6 months we travelled around. Went straight down to Gibraltar because we arrived in January, which is the middle of winter.
Yeah, you can get south.
Went down through Madrid. In fact, woke up the first night because we never went into a camp. We just stopped on the side of the road, put this lid up. And had a bit of a can there and then this tent thing. And in the morning, that was just a big layer of ice through there. It was so bloody cold outside Madrid.
Hell.
And so we got on, headed through Toledo down to Gibraltar. Then slowly, for 6 months, came up to Italy, all the, Florence, you name it, Milan. Because in those days, we just parked anywhere we liked and nobody, we were very careful. We didn't have, Angela had nappies, God bless her. None of these.
Well, these disposables.
So how the hell she washed nappies and kept them clean, living in a bloody van. You know, no toilets. We'd go out, I had a spade, we'd go out in the bush and dig a hole and do your business.
And you were probably out looking at architecture the whole
all
time.
All the time, yeah. Look at these. Running from one cathedral to another cathedral to another. To
this.
And Angela, I'm dragging Angela around. How the hell she did
She's busy with the baby and the nappies. Meanwhile, you're taking photos of cathedrals.
And,
it's a great thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, she deserves about 15 BCs, I think, really.
Oh, good on you. So is architecture and art and design always been a passion?
Yes, I think so. I wasn't a particularly good artist as such, but I went through school with Michael Smither, who was a close friend of mine.
Yeah, I know his
name. And we had a guy called Frank Tett. He was the teacher who did whatever they called it in those days. It wasn't art, it was something. But so he saw that, because I picked up technical drawing very quickly.
Yeah.
Somehow or other, I just had this inane knack for doing technical drawings. And Mike Smither, of course, was a pretty cool artist. So Frank Tett, who we called Texas Tett for some reason, he stuck us in a special room and gave us special tuition. And Mike is still a close friend of mine, and I've got 31 of his works.
Yeah.
Biggest private collection of
really?
I've got some brilliant smother works.
Beautiful. The little pebbles on the beach.
I've got an unbelievable collection.
Wow.
Unbelievable. It's
beautiful.
It's fantastic.
So tell us about the business, the Boon. When did you decide you were going to set that up?
Well, I was working in a when I came back, I joined a firm. In fact, they asked me to come back. I wasn't intending to, but we'd had this second child in London. My son was born there. And interesting too, because, you know, when Caroline was born, the daughter, we were living in Auckland, and her doctor was on the North Shore, so she knew something was happening. So I took her to hospital, and I stayed with a friend and didn't hear anything. I didn't have mobiles in those days. And so I thought, I'd better go around and see what's happening. And I go around there and find that my daughter had been born about 4 hours beforehand.
Oh, dear.
I thought, that's bloody interesting. And then the next one, we were in London in this flat, and it was October, and it was misty and cold and bloody whatever. We didn't have a phone, couldn't afford a phone.
Yeah.
And we had a midwife in those, because you couldn't go to hospital. Well, the second child in London, in England, you couldn't go to hospital, had to be born at home.
Right, just to keep the numbers
down.
That's
an interesting experience. Here I am with no family, on my own in the middle of bloody London. So Angela knew something was happening, so I would go down to the phone box down below, ring up the phone, look, I think I need somebody to come. The midwife comes around, who was a assistant midwife.
You literally called the midwife.
This lassie comes around, and she was full of the flu, snuffling and carrying on. She looked, mucked around, poked around a bit and said, no, nothing's going to happen, and fled. And Angela said, no, something's going on here, something's going on. So sure enough, I go down again in the mist and the fog at about midnight again, a bit later. Dial in, and I get this midwife, who she's a bloody character. And she said, right, on its way, we've got to do. So here I am. One time I learned 4 hours later she'd born. This one, here I am delivering him.
You're the catching position.
Talk about the bloody, talk about the yin and yang. So that was an interesting experience.
Yeah,
I've got to say.
Yeah.
And it was a Friday night, and I go back to work on Monday morning at the office. I did say something to the guys, and nobody took any interest at all. They couldn't, the palms were bloody hard shots. I mean, it was a great office. It was really, everyone minded their own business. But they couldn't care less.
Wow.
I had a baby in the flat at home.
Sure.
Ah, goodness.
So that's what made you think about coming back to New Zealand then?
Yeah, so then I thought, well, this is silly. And I got a call, actually, from a company called Baring & Thompson. And so they said, would you come back? They desperately wanted something. Nobody would come to New Plymouth. No architects wanted to work in New Plymouth or Taranaki for that reason. So I thought, well, the time's right now. I've got this other baby, and it's because I don't know how long I would have stayed in.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved London. I loved living there.
Yeah.
And so we, I think back, and I thought, bugger, I'm going to head back. And I stuck Angela and two kids on a ship, which took 6 weeks. I stuck her on the ship and left her, and then I went and got on a plane. I went all over Europe, visiting places, including to India, to Chandigarh.
Wow.
I arrived the day before her in Auckland.
So I said, how was your 6 weeks, love? I had a great time.
She's on her own with two kids.
She does deserve a medal, this woman. She's incredible.
She does. Yeah.
So you came back in New Plymouth now.
Back to join these guys, and I was still pretty aggressive in doing things, and I'd set up a meeting. We had an office which was called Baring, Thompson, Buchan and Boone at that stage. No, it had changed to Boone, Thompson, Buchan and Chong, was at that stage. And I said, let's meet every Monday, because we'd have a week plan. We'd plan our week. And we had a reasonable staff, I think, 20-odd people, which was quite big for province. Yeah. Because most provincial firms are only one and two people. You know, we're quite.
There's not the work for it. But
quite unique, really. Yeah. And so I set up this meeting to say, right, we'd plan the week. And of course, I'd be out doing whatever, and suddenly I'd get another job. And I'd say to the guy, they said, well, do you do a factory for us, a house or an office building? And I'd say, oh, yeah, I can knock you out. I'll get you out some sketch plans by Friday. So, of course, I'd come into the office and tell these guys this, and they'd
oh, what have you done?
So what were they doing? They started to complain that I was bringing in too much work. So I said, right, oh, boys, I gave them 6 months' notice.
Right, I'm out of here.
I'm out of here. I'm going to set up on my own. And I learnt afterwards that they said, well, he'll never survive on his own because he's only surviving because of us. And, of course, they're all gone, and I'm still here bigger, brighter, there you go, bigger than ever.
50 years later, plus. So what were there some projects in your early days that's put you on the map, you know, when you want your signature?
Well, I suppose I was doing, because I'd been involved in, we'll come back to the Saudi job, because the Ministry of Works didn't have architects in Taranaki, and there was a lot of work being done, like Kapuni.
Yeah.
And the Kapuni was designed by some big English company that did all the engineering and the geotech and all that stuff. But, of course, these places were quite significant. They had laboratories and offices and staff rooms and, you know, all sorts of things, architectural stuff. And they were, I think, the first one I did, and I'm talking here a long time ago, 50-plus years ago, first part of Kapuni, I think, stage one. And they had a provisional sum, which is something you do. Yeah. Like, you know, we normally do it for an office building. You'll have a provisional sum of, say, 60,000 or 100,000 for hardware or something like that, which you can come and pick your light fittings or you don't necessarily design them all at the start. Well, they had a provisional sum of $1 million for the office buildings.
Oof.
So here was, I said, here's a site, build us an office building for $1 million. So I did it easy.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and that's how it started.
Oh, good on you.
And then because of that, I went from one thing to another, and that's how I ended up with the Saudi job, basically.
Just keep going from
because
there.
Because of my reputation for good design and meeting targets, budgets, I was manic about being on time and on budget.
So there's a thing there, though, because you're not only the lead architect and, by the sound of it, the lead business development person, but you're also owning the business.
Yeah.
Was there tension there at times between the
not
business
really.
Side of it and the architect?
I think, no, I think when I left the branch, what I call the Bram Street branch, the Boone Thompson Buckland Chong, Paul Goldsmith was a relatively young architect, and I said, I'm off, and I didn't talk to any of the staff at all. And, of course, several of them didn't want to stay there.
Right.
They wanted to come with me.
For you,
and I didn't persuade them or do anything. And they reckoned I'd drag them away, but I hadn't. They wanted to come because they preferred working
your
with
style.
Me. Yeah. And so we formed a superb friendship as well because we're both in surf life saving.
Yeah.
And he's a gifted architect. And, you know, he was just, we trusted each other and we respected each other.
Yeah.
And we just had a wonderful friendship and partnership, and I always treated him equally, even though technically I could have. People had percentages and things, but as far as I was concerned, he was equal partner all the way through, financially and every other way. So I was very fortunate at that. Although I think, you know, when people say, "Gosh, you've been lucky," I say it's funny how, you know, the
harder you work,
the harder the work, the luckier I get.
Yeah.
It's funny that, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and I did work hard, long, long hours.
Yeah.
Saturday night, you know, I'd go home for dinner always with the kids. I'd work weekends, I'd work Sunday. I'd never miss sports on a Saturday.
I know a few architects, and one of the things that they have in common is they do long hours.
Long hours. If you want to succeed,
it's
a fool of a job because it's labour intensive.
Yeah. And you're out on site.
There's no substitute for time as far as you've got to put the time in because you can get. Normally, when you get a design and you understand the site, which is a key thing, you know, you've got to site the driver of these things, the climate, the site, the topography and all the rest of it. But you'll get an idea, a gem of an idea, but then you've got to really work and work and work to make it happen.
Yeah.
And there's just no substitute, unfortunately.
Put the work in.
For hours.
Yeah.
I think, I'm not sure now because, you know, the guys in our office now will sit there glued it. I mean, I'd go bloody mad looking at these screens all day. And half the time they have programs. You want a four-bedroom house, press the button. up comes a bloody four-bedroom house.
Wow.
I think, I'm not sure. It's like,
how does that work? Well, you had your T-square and
I stand standing at the board. And... Yeah, bent over a board. And,
wow.
Yeah, smoking.
Oh, really?
In those days. Dropping cigarettes and because it was tracing paper to burn the holes in the tracing paper.
It turned up one day and there's a swimming pool. Who designed it? Oh, no, that was just a bit of ash fell on the plan. We put you
a swimming pool.
Thank God I gave that terrible habit up a long time ago.
It feels like Mad Men, you know, that TV thing. And you guys are all sitting around smoking and designing programs. That's incredible.
Well, that's what you did in those good old days. You know, you go home from a meeting and you hang your stuff up. I used to have it hanging in the veranda because it stunk.
Yeah.
Bloody cigarettes.
Bloody, why did we think that was a good idea?
Oh, God.
Well, you've got 50 years plus worth of stories, 87 years of stories. But if you were to look back on one of the buildings or work that you've done that you think encapsulates your signature of you, what would it be?
Well, probably, apart from my own house, which I'm very proud of.
And won an award, I hear, for.
Yeah, yes. Got a national award for that, which was quite significant. No other house in Taranaki's won a national award. They get plenty of local awards.
Yeah, amazing.
But I think probably the original Gavette Brewster Art Gallery, where I converted the old bug house, we called it the Regent Cinema, because I used to go there and watch Captain Marvel and run the Jaffers down the floor so they'd rattle down the floor from up on the things.
You were that rascal. So, because I'm curious about this. So you were in the Regent, you loved that building, and you thought this later someone gave you permission to do the work.
Yes, it was interesting because Mike Smither and John Matthews, I think, Mrs. Brewster, who was a real character, she had set up this fund, an endowment to build a. She was an amazing woman. I only met her once. She was bedridden, and she was wife of an ear, nose, and throat specialist here, Rex Brewster. They didn't have any children, but she was wealthy in her own right. She came from a very wealthy family, and he was pretty wealthy, so had all his money, and decided she wanted to set up a gallery. She wanted a permanent gallery, but she didn't want it to be another Wellington City, Dunedin City, you know, covering everything from, you know, Adam was a cowboy through to whatever, you know. So she said she had this brief, two things happened. They had a guy called Smith, who was an art historian from Melbourne, was brought over and had a meeting up in the, still is a room up in the top of the library, things now it was the Moore Memorial Hall. And there was a meeting there, and this guy, Smith, said there's, if you're going to set up this gallery and you're serious about it, and I think she'd given £50,000, which was a lot of money in those days, and he said, you've got to do two things. You have to get a premises quickly, and you have to employ an architect quickly. You have to get these people to work together in the particular, if it's an existing building or new building or whatever the site, and get the brief, get your brief organised. And John Maynard was appointed as director. He was an Australian character. He's still a friend of mine, and he was an art historian teacher. An amazing choice of director, because he was just had something special.
Yeah, right.
And he and I remember meeting Mrs. Brewster with John when he first came, and he set up this policy only from 19. We're going to have contemporary art. No, it wasn't Mrs. Brewster, it was John Maynard. Contemporary art from 1960, because it was 1960 when we were doing this, and because we didn't want to be the same as any other gallery. We don't want old stuff. You can, and we'll have a policy of touring exhibitions at least for 2 months, say three a year or two a year or whatever, so we could bring in extra good work, because it would take a long time to build a collection. Sitting there with Mrs. Brewster, lying very frail in the bed, and John said, Mrs. Brewster, we've decided to have a policy that only includes work from 1960, which means that some of the works that you have gifted, some of these quite valuable Renaissance or, you know, whatever, old landscape paintings, quite good ones, there were three particularly. She said, he said that, unfortunately, Mrs. this won't fit into the policy. That's okay, Mr. Maynard. If that's what you think is the right thing to do, I'm very happy for you to sell those and use those funds. She was just an extraordinary woman.
That is incredible.
She
didn't have any gift.
Yes, it was. It was. It was. It just shows you how enlightened she was, really.
And it set up, obviously,
that set tone. And then, between having a brilliant architect. And a brilliant,
very modest, I hear, this architect. He's probably one of the best.
He is. He's very shy and talk much.
No, I hear that.
No.
Yeah. But the Gavette Bruce is such an iconic thing in here in New Plymouth. It's, you know, people come from around the country to
I think even nationally we have a reputation that's...
very much.
You know, we, as I said before, we punch above our weight in Taranaki in so many things. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Did you know Len Lai?
Yes, I met him several times.
Yeah.
And I had him up home for dinner a couple of times when he was here. And we went and sat on the beach one day. It was quite intriguing. I took him out to Oakura. I said, come on here, Len, we'll go out. Because he was a really sharp, big eyes and bald head and real character. And I said, you know, we went and got some fish and chips from the fish shop up there. Sat down on a log on the beach with a Coca-Cola. Here I am with Len Lai sitting there on the beach. And he said it was one of the best meals he'd ever had.
Yeah.
And he was that sort of guy. Yeah. Had him up home for dinner. He was just pretty intense and pretty clever.
But that's the thing about, you know, you sense the person. In 50 years of your professional career and your signatures are all over the region and now the world with the 3R District, you've made a huge impression on this town.
Well, I'm very grateful for the opportunities I've been given, really. And I think I feel that I've done as well as I could do. I've done my best all the time. And generally, I think I feel that I've contributed something.
I'm sure you have.
What do they say when you leave this time? If you can look back and say, well, maybe it's a bit better than when I arrived. I feel, you know, without getting up myself, to feel that I've helped. And it hasn't only been me. I've had a lot of people as well. But so I'm just privileged, even the fact I'm still here.
Still here and firing on all cylinders, I can tell.
It's pretty amazing.
You're a very sprightly 87-year-old. What is the final question for you? Because we're going to have to wrap up. I could talk for hours with you. Yeah. But our final question, what is the best and worst bit of business advice you've ever had?
The best bit, I think, probably to believe in yourself. Probably, I think, I've always, because as a kid I was quite shy and I was young and... somehow, as the youngest of three boys, I had to fend for myself. And my mother had been one of five girls in her family, and apparently she was horrified when I was born. It was a third boy.
Another bloody boy.
I just feel that being... So I was a bit neglected almost, because my oldest brother was goody-goody two-shoes. The middle brother was a real hard shot. He's dead now, but he was a real character. And I was just left to my own devices. And I think because of that, I've always been independent.
Yeah.
I've made my own way. I've done my own thing. I haven't relied on anybody else to do anything.
Yeah. And you believed in yourself.
I believed in myself. And somehow or other, and of course I was given this opportunity by Frank Tett to say he had faith in me that I actually had some potential.
Yeah.
And when I got to university, I just flourished.
Fabulous. Mm. Well, it's so nice to have met you and talk to you, Terry.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming in. And look, I hope that you do start slowing down in 15 to 20 years from now.
Yeah, 20 years.
Yeah, just give yourself a break, yeah.
Yeah, I probably will. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Terry.
You're welcome. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening. And a special thanks to Venture Taranaki for making this Power Up podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode, there are plenty more like it. Check out the Power Up podcast home on whatever platform you're listening to. They're a great way for budding entrepreneurs to learn from the lessons of others. Speaking of people trying to build businesses, Venture Taranaki is a great place to go for free startup clinics, advisory support, business mentoring, masterclasses, investment support, and networking opportunities. If you want help bringing your idea to life, talk to Venture Taranaki today. And one more thing, if you've got this far and you've enjoyed the episode, please rate it, review it, or subscribe for more. It helps others find us.